This summer, America turns 250 years old, and there's no better way to celebrate than getting outside and exploring this great nation. One way to do that is to rent a camper or RV from Outdoorsy. Outdoorsy is the most trusted RV rental marketplace in the U.S., making it easy for anyone over 21 to rent an RV or camper without owning one. With Outdoorsy, you can drive it yourself, tow it, or even have it delivered and fully set up at your destination. With comprehensive insurance, 24/7 customer support, and roadside assistance, Outdoorsy gives you the peace of mind you need when on the road. Outdoorsy is even the perfect option for your next out-of-state hunting or fishing trip. Right now, my listeners can have all service fees removed from their bookings in 2026 with code EMPIRE at Outdoorsy.com. That's Outdoorsy.com and use code EMPIRE at checkout to remove service fees. It's time to get outside and enjoy your summer. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Fully Loaded Chew is tobacco-free, long cut, and pouches that gives you the same pack, dip, spit, and buzz that you're used to without tobacco. Fully Loaded Chew comes in 9 flavors and is made with all food-grade ingredients and tobacco-free nicotine. To give us a try, head on over to FullyLoadedChew.com for a $1 can of chew with free shipping when you enter the code OUTDOOR1, OUTDOOR, and the number 1. For more information on our product line, visit FullyLoadedChew.com. Go Wild is a free social community created for and by hunters. This means that unlike mainstream social media, your trophy pictures won't be censored. They're encouraged. As you spend time on Go Wild, you will earn awesome rewards such as gift cards, free swag, and big discounts on brands like Garmin and Vortex. You will even earn $10 just for signing up. Visit downloadgowild.com and sign up today.
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving, princess meeting and greeting, lightsaber clashing, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping, Banshee flying, Space Mountain launching, galaxy rewinding, what is the whole network galaxy rewinding, fireworks igniting, world of other worlds, for whatever you love. Infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth, Walt Disney World Resort.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
All right, guys, welcome to today's show. And on the show today, I'm super pumped. I'm joined by an amazing guy, somebody that I've listened to and looked up to in the podcast world for years and years. And that is Dan Johnson. I mean, I listened to him and Mark Kenyon go back and forth for, gosh, hours upon hours, talking about all their trips, and it was cool to hear them going into like their experiences as they started to venture out west. And so we're going to pick Dan's brain about what Western hunting looks like for him today, some of the gear that he uses, strategies, things like that. It's going to be a great BS session with me and the nine-fingered legend, Dan Johnson. Now, before we do, I'm going to dive into a bit of non-Western related information or story. I guess that's a better way to say it. I've been out turkey hunting, and here in Missouri, I normally have pretty good luck. I'm not a good turkey hunter. I'm going to throw that out there, but I enjoy doing it because it's in the spring. Nothing else is really going on, to be honest. That's the main reason I picked it up, and I found myself enjoying it more and more. Now, it's not my number one. It's not my go-to. I don't sit in a deer stand thinking about turkey hunting. Just to put it in perspective where I land. This morning was nuts. I mean, I bet you, this is no joke, I bet you Within the first hour of sitting, I heard between 500 and 700 gobbles. That might seem insane, but I'm telling you, there was probably 10 to a dozen Jakes and Toms in this tiny little, like, maybe it's 15 acres, 20 acres, I really don't know, woodlot, and they were all up there in the roost, and they were going nonstop. I bet you there wasn't 10 to 15 second, like that much time in between every single gobble. And once one would gobble, they all would go off. And it was just that all morning long. And then I came up with a big goose egg. I had an opportunity at a tom. Actually, me and my buddy Austin, we were sitting there. We were sitting together, thought it was going to happen. It never did. And so we're like, dude, we're going to just push into the woods a little bit if we need to go get set up somewhere new and try to get to them. And we didn't make it very far into the woods, and we could see this tom just dancing up on the hill above us. He couldn't see us. We tried to get close enough, and it just wasn't the right shot, if you know what I mean. Like, I could see his head. I had a tiny window. I didn't have a range on him, but it would have been probably like right at the edge of my effective range, and there was too much cover. I mean, neither of us felt comfortable taking the shot, so we didn't. But nonetheless, it was a fun morning. Enough about turkey hunting, though, because if you're listening to this, you want to hear about Western hunting. So we're going to dive into that right now. You're listening to The Western Rookie, a hunting podcast full of tips, tricks, and strategies from seasoned Western hunters. There are plenty of opportunities out there. We just need to learn how to take on the challenges.
Hunting is completely different up there.
That part's 26 big game animals.
You can fool their eyes, but you can't fool their nose.
200 yards back to the road turned into 3 miles back the other way.
It's always cool seeing new hunters go and harvest an animal.
I don't know what to expect.
If there's anybody I want in the woods with me, it'll be you.
All right, guys, welcome to today's show. And joining me on the show today is the man behind Nine Finger Chronicles, Sportsman's Nation. Actually, I don't know, are we talking about changes already, Dan?
Yeah, I mean, it's coming. It's coming. We're going to go from Sportsman's Nation to Sportsman's Empire. I haven't made the official announcement yet. There's a whole bunch of little things. Same logo, same platform. Everything's going to be the same. It's just there's going to be a little bit of a name change. So now we've officially talked about it.
Nice. Well, as I'm sure you guys have guessed now, Dan Johnson is with me on the show. And we're going to be talking about Western hunting today, both past and future, what our experiences have been, what tags we've got for this year, and trips we plan to go on. So you ready to jump into all that?
Yeah, I'm down, man. This is everything that I do is really heavy whitetail focused. And so I'm excited because some of these hunts are definitely some of the most looked forward to, I guess, trips of the year.
Yeah, I think there's just something different about Western hunting or traveling somewhere to hunt. Like, yeah, I've had those spots that I could go right out my back door and sit, but it's totally different when you actually like get in the vehicle, make a trip. You have to plan, you have to prepare the food you're going to bring or how long you're going to be gone. Sometimes that comes with complications, like explaining to your wife how long you're going to be gone. But yeah,
that's a fact.
Going out west, I mean, I feel like it's a lot of hunters' dreams, but not a ton of people actually venture out and do it. It's becoming more and more popular now, but it seems like in the past, growing up, especially for me, I think I knew one person who went out west hunting. Everybody else just kind of hung out at home, did the 9-day Orange Army, and that was about it.
Yeah. Man, I tell you what, I used to be in that same category. I never did the gun hunt. I haven't really done the gun hunting thing. It's all been archery for me. But I went out you know, I've been out west a couple times and just heard the stories from other guys talking about, you know, hey, you need to get out and give something else a try outside of whitetails. And so I went, man, it was 2014. I went on my first elk hunting trip that same year. I went to Nebraska looking for mule deer and antelope. Struck out, of course. And so those two, that 1 year and those two trips kind of set the tone for what, like, now what I get excited about on some of these Western trips.
Yeah, I mean, what have you found is the thing that's different that draws you back there every year from the type of hunting you're used to?
That's a great question, and it is 100% the landscape. I love the feeling that some of these environments, you put yourself into an environment and you're a long way from a road, or you've packed in. And when I mean a long way, it's not like we're in Frank Church in Idaho, right? Where we're getting dropped off and we're, you know, 20 miles from the nearest road. I haven't done anything that crazy yet, but when you can go to a place and at night you're in your tent and you get up the next morning and you look in the sky and the stars are crystal clear and that you can get to a high spot and you can see forever, right? And so it's the feeling of feeling small in those environments and feeling like I'm insignificant in the grand scheme of things. For some reason, I love that feeling. And from just an experience standpoint, I love going and experiencing that. But then you mix it with, you know, my passion for bow hunting, and it's just a win-win from that point on.
Oh yeah. Anytime you can get into a beautiful landscape out west, even just being there, I tell my wife that all the time. I'm like, just being there, if I come back without any meat, it's going to be an amazing vacation in the wilderness. Yeah. Being out there, you know, hopefully where I go, I like to not encounter as many people. It comes in handy if you get in a tight situation or you need a hand packing meat out. But there's something about being in such a vast landscape and the adventure of, like, in my tree stand, if I see deer moving over a hill in the opposite direction, I don't go after them. If I sit on a property and I notice the neighbor's property looks like it has everything that a big buck would want, I typically can't go over there and just hunt. The adventure of being able to actually go, like, once you're set up glassing and you see a valley or a creek bottom on the other side of the valley that you want to go check out, you can just go do it.
Right. Yeah, for the most part, the access to all the public land that the West offers is incredible, and the ability to just move and go as far as you want or stay close as you want, and the ability to go look for animals. Now, like here in the whitetail world, if my farm's dead during the rut, let's say, there's not much I can do. I can be patient and I can try to sit it out and maybe try to find little pockets where they're at. But if they're on the neighbor's farm, they're on the neighbor's farm, right? Out west, man, you can go for miles if you want and just explore all of that terrain and that landscape and keep looking for them all day long. And especially when I go out on my mule deer hunts, right? It's like you can scrub ground all day if you want looking for these creatures. And I don't know, I love being able to actively hunt all day long.
Yeah, I would 100% agree with that. Growing up tree stand hunting, and even talking with other whitetail hunters, it's like, yeah, you know, the 2 hours in the morning and the 2 hours in the evening are typically when you're going to see the most deer, right after daylight and then right before dark. And with elk, with mule deer, I haven't had any experience antelope hunting yet, but the ability to actually go after them, or looking forward to those moments when they go and bed down and you might be able to get a little bit closer to them. You might be able to put a good stalk on a bedded buck or a bedded bull on the side of a mountain. Like, it's just cool to be able to do all of that. I will say it is freaking exhausting though. Like, doing an all day sit in a tree stand is one thing, but being on foot pursuing animals, getting your heart rate racing and then dropping, and then the changes in weather, that can take a toll on you for sure.
Yeah. I the exhausting part is no joke, right? Now I've had to pull some whitetails out of some pretty thick terrain, but it's only like for, oh man, I don't know. 200 yards would probably be the longest I've ever had to drag a whitetail out of here in Iowa. Now out there, I had to do like a 3.5 mile pack out, for a mule deer that we shot. I went with my buddy the first year we ever went mule deer hunting, and that pack out, was, you know, it was the end of the day. I probably have enough food in my pack, you know, like, cause typically we would finish the day and then go back to the tent. Well, we shot this mule deer at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And then the time it took us to quarter it or to debone it, quarter it up, take the hide off, get the, you know, get the head off, get everything packed up. And we had a little granola bar before we started out on this 3.5 mile pack out. And this was in some guys would probably laugh at me for saying this flat land of western South Dakota. And so we packed it out. And by the time that we got out, you know, we hiked that 3.5 miles, it was like 8 o'clock at night. The sun was just going down and my legs, I'm glad we got to the truck when we did, because there was no way I was taking another step. I mean, that was like 100-pound pack out for each of us, and it was pretty brutal. And so we definitely burnt a lot more calories then than pulling up, you know, a truck to a field edge and pulling a whitetail into it.
Oh yeah, it's funny. I look at like dragging a deer out of the woods now. This past year, I had to drag 3 out in one day, and that's because, you know, I hunt with a lot of family when I go to Wisconsin, and there's just a lot of deer. And so I always help some of my family's getting older or has knee issues or things like that. And so when it comes to dragging, it's me and my brother and my cousin. And I was a part of 3 deer drag outs, and it's only on 40 acres. That's what we hunt up there. And so we were in the back corner of it to the front. And I was like, man, this is exhausting. And then I look back at like packing an elk out, and that's exhausting. And then you still have 90% of the way to go. And I've never seen people get so angry at like terrain changes or Mother Nature just by packing meat out. It's grueling. And it's one of those things where you in the moment think it's never going to end. And when you get to the vehicle or the side by side or whatever, you're thankful it's done. And you're like, man, I never want to do that again. And then a week later, you're missing it already.
Right. And that's the struggle, you know, for some of us, it's that struggle that is, I don't know, so much fun. And like, where do I get my water from? And, you know, there's a whole bunch of different ways to hunt the West, right? But for example, this year, I'm going to be going 2 miles in. Roughly, if you draw a straight line, it's like 1.5 miles, but I got to go around, you know, like this very small hill area that is vertical. So I got to go around it, hike in, I'll bring water in with me. But, you know, like one of the things I absolutely love to do is I just bought a brand new sleeping bag. It's about 1.5 pounds lighter than my old sleeping bag. I'm going to probably buy a new tent. And my old tent is great. It works perfect, but I want to be able to carry more water in, and now I have to look for water and all these things that have to go right in order for not only just your stay to be, I guess, somewhat comfortable, but then on top of that, go and try to kill an animal as well. Yeah. And so that planning, the preparation, it's an all year thing. It's very fun. The hunt itself is fun. It's unique. It's different. It's taxing on the body and the mind. And so when you win in an environment like that, it just makes that whole experience that much greater. And I shot a whitetail in South Dakota last year, but that was one of those things where it just kind of fell into my lap and I took advantage of that, but it's not my ultimate goal of trying to get out there and kill a backcountry mule deer.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like archery definitely takes things to a whole new level also. I mean, that's what you're doing. You're having to get way closer than I've ever had to for any Western hunts. And that's really intriguing. But on the gear side of things, it's funny because there are people who get into Western hunting or backcountry hunting, and by the time their first year is up, or maybe their second year, they are just as into minimalizing the gear that they have and lightening their load. I've been getting into that recently. The first couple of years that I went out, though, I was definitely like that Eastern guy that showed up with stuff that was way too heavy, way too much stuff. And part of me doesn't really care to lighten everything up that much, just because there's something about like suffering through it and just like having a hard job and then completing that job. But at the same time, I'm in the same boat with you as water. We don't have water where we elk hunt. And so when we do a spike camp a couple miles back in, everything has to go on our back. And that can be a huge challenge in itself.
Yeah, that's a fact. That is a fact.
What does this year look like for you? Are you, I know in the past we've talked, and even before the recording, that you don't, or you didn't put in for any tags. Is that something that you always avoid? Are you just going places where you can get an over-the-counter tag, or are there places that you're just hoping to draw down the road?
Yeah. So I'm stacking preference points right now in Wyoming. I actually might go to Colorado this year on an over-the-counter hunt, but my preference point plan at this point is very minimal. I pretty much have all my chips into one basket, and that's Wyoming. I have several years worth of preference points for elk and several years worth of preference points for deer and antelope out there. And so I'm biding time, and I'm trying to get my youngest into kindergarten before I go and do that. So once my youngest is in kindergarten, then I feel like I can get away for longer periods of time. That way, you know, I mean, he's in daycare now, which isn't, you know, that big of a deal, but I feel like that's, when I finally draw Wyoming, it's going to be probably a 2 week hunt. I'm going to put a lot of energy into that because it's taken me so long to acquire all of these preference points. Same with mule deer and same with, antelope out there. I mean, these are going to be trips that I take, and I focus a lot of time out there and I probably won't be doing any other hunts on those years. But in the meantime, everything that I've been doing is over the counter out west. And it's either been, you know, like Idaho back. I haven't hunted Idaho again. I've done that just the 1 year. And that was over the counter at the time. I don't think Iowa or Idaho's over the counter anymore. Colorado, every time I've gone to Colorado, that's been 3 years. That's been an over-the-counter brutal hunt. And then over-the-counter in Nebraska, you have to apply for it, but it's a guaranteed draw right now, is South Dakota, and you can hunt for whitetail and mule deer out there in both Nebraska and South Dakota. So as far as Western hunts are concerned, Western Nebraska and Western Kansas are on the table this year for my trips. So whether I'm sleeping in the back of a truck or hiking in on one of those hunts, to set up a kind of a base camp before I head further in, that's what's on the schedule as of right now for Western hunts, and with the goal of like just strictly getting a mule deer.
Nice. What, you'd mentioned that all of your eggs are in Wyoming's basket as far as preference points and trying to draw. Is there a reason specifically that you chose Wyoming over places like Montana, Idaho, Colorado, Utah?
You know, I really haven't put enough research into that to give you an educated answer, but I will say that the reason that I've focused on Wyoming is because the preference point system is so easy. Right. All you have to do is just on July 1st, I go by my preference point and then I just forget about it. The next year, July, go by my preference points. And so what I'm doing is I'm just building up those preference points until I can say, okay, I want to go hunt now. And so after a handful of years, I'm going to go hunt some of these spots. And, or when I do decide to go hunt some of these spots, I want to make it worthwhile. And that's an easy way of collecting preference points. I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to sign up for I don't have to buy a license. I don't have to do a whole bunch of other, apply, then get your money back and do all this other stuff for a preference point. It's very simple. And I'm sure there's other states that have that same system. It's just that's when I started, that's what I was doing. And then I stuck with it.
Nice. I know with Colorado, their system has changed quite a bit. When I first started hunting out there, I think it was the first year that they went to the system where you don't have to pay for the hunt up front and then get refunded. And that blew my mind that they ever did that. Cause I mean, if you're putting in, especially for a non-resident tag for anything, you're looking at several $100 up to, like a moose tag for a non-resident is like $2,400. And I just can't imagine having to put in or have all of that money available. Say you want to put in for a preference point for antelope, mule deer, bear, and elk. You're looking at $1,500+ that you have to have and be okay with not having for 90 days before you get refunded.
Yeah.
And I'm like, man, I probably wouldn't have started hunting out there had it not been for the switch over to where, I mean, it was still a complicated process, but I didn't have to have the funds ready to go at the day that I applied.
Yeah. Yep. And that's the same with Wyoming. When you do apply, you get your money back if you don't draw, but I don't know. That's just how they do it. So I don't really complain. You know, I got to have the money anyway. So you might as well have it when you apply for the tag and potentially not get it. Then, have to wait until the season, the actual season starts or when the tag is actually allocated to you. So whatever, I go by with whatever rules they are, and I make little documentations and I keep notes of how many preference points I have in certain areas. And then when my schedule meets up with, when my schedule allows me to go do this, I'm going to go all in.
Yeah. That's going to be exciting. I mean, it's going to be a fun message to get or an email to get, but at the same time, then it's like game time. It's no longer dreaming.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Full on planning. It's about to happen.
Right. Right. Absolutely, man. And then that's when the real fun begins, right?
Oh yeah. That I've gotten those calls from a couple friends. One drew a moose tag 1 year, and a couple of years later drew a mountain goat tag. And it was like, dude, you'll never believe the message I just got. And I'm like, oh crap, we're moose hunting this fall, aren't we? And sure enough, and it was, I mean, it seemed like every week I was over there, we're checking out maps, planning scouting trips out there for the summer before. And then, the time came, and luckily all the work paid off. We did a bunch of scouting. We found, 23 moose in 2 days when we went out to scout. And then opening day, he connected on an amazing bull. And so
awesome.
It's definitely a different world, though. It's not like, hey, I got permission on this property. Now I have all year to get out, hang out there, check trail cameras. When it's out of state, when you're traveling hundreds of miles for it, it's a whole different type of preparation.
Yeah. That's the truth, my friend.
What you mentioned you do a lot of the over-the-counter hunts. Are there places that you've become familiar with that you go back every year now? Like you hunt maybe the same valley or the same drainage?
Yeah, so I think that's what part of this learning curve is that I talk about on my podcast for sure, and I hear other guys talk about is – so – I don't know if I just am too busy of a person. And what I mean by that is I have a problem sitting still for so long or staying in one place for so long. And so when I would go out west in some of these states to mule deer hunt, I wouldn't give an area enough time to cycle through. And I think that's part of the problem. I know there's great deer in the area. I've seen them there before previous years. I see really good numbers there every year in some of these places every year I've gone, but I'll go in, especially if I'm hunting from my truck and I'll walk in, I'll give it a day. Yeah, there's nothing here. And then I'll go to a different spot. What I should be doing, and this is just, maybe this is the right thing to do, maybe it's not, but give some of these places a little bit more time than just 24 hours, like a morning hunt and then an afternoon hunt, or an afternoon hunt and then a morning hunt, before I make my decision to go and head back to, I don't know, move to the next spot. So yes, that's something that I am in the process of doing right now, is learning not only just one giant piece of public land, but valleys and drainages within those that in the past have held the deer. And now with that, I got to try to find those ambush spots within those drainages to try to get on them. And so that's something that I am in the process of doing right now, not only while I'm out there hunting, but e-scouting as well. If the wind's doing this, if the thermals are doing this, blah, you know, like always cycling through hunt stand and putting pins where I think, oh, this might be a good glassing spot, or this might be a good spot to ambush, or I'll be in the shade at this time of day, or they'll be in the shade this time of the day. So just like always trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together. And what I really need to do is just like take that mindset, but apply it over, instead of one day, over 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I've heard of people going out and, you know, they'll go out a couple days before and they'll scout and they'll see if they can locate certain animals that they want to target. But when you're traveling a long distance and, you know, you've got a family back home and a job, and it's not always easy, or it's not always possible to go out ahead of time. And so,
yeah,
I think it can be super effective to get out and scout while you're hunting. You know, you're constantly looking for the next vantage point, the next ambush spot, like you had mentioned.
Trust me, man, I want to be out there. I would love to take a summer scouting trip and throw trail cameras out in some of these spots every single year. It's just logistically, it's not possible with three kids and crazy schedules and kids' schedules and wife's schedules and all that stuff. So that's why when it's time to go out and hunt, I hunt as hard as I possibly can.
Oh, absolutely. You got to make the most of every opportunity. And when I'm back home, I find myself, it gets, as season goes, it's more and more tempting to sleep in instead of get out in the tree stand. But out there, like, you, that might be your only opportunity. And to waste one of, you know, 6 days that you might have just isn't an option. Now, when you're out there, like in places that you've gone and you've had success, is it hard to, trying to think how to say this, I visualize like how it's gone in the past, and I think I can just imagine a bull coming up the same ridge. Is it hard for you to like move away from places that you've had success in the past because you think it could happen again, or is the adventure of finding a new spot even greater than your thought of it repeating itself?
I guess I really don't think that way, really. I try to go back to spots that I've seen deer in the past. And then it's, for me, it's just a matter of, like I said earlier, it's just a matter of time. You know, like how much time am I going to give an area? And the more I think about it over the years, I'm not giving some of these areas enough time to rebound every single year. And, or like to, you know, have deer cycle through, because, you know, you go there and you only hunt 24 hours. Well, we all know that, especially out west, deer have much more, especially for mule deer, what I've found, they have a bigger range than a whitetail. They travel further distances between water and food sources. And I don't know, they probably, because of that travel pattern, they cover more ground. They're not always going to the same, you know, the same locations every single day. And so like for me, I like to go back to the spots. It's just a matter of giving those spots enough time to see deer movement and then move on to the next spot.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, with whitetail, you know how mature bucks are. They could have a really, really tight core range and home range, but like you said, I mean, elk and mule deer, even antelope, they'll just travel for miles and miles. And that's where my mind is blown in looking at some of these guys who will follow the same deer or the same elk year after year, and they'll wait till it gets to be 200 inches. And I'm like, man, I don't understand. That's just got to be hours and hours behind the glass all the time.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it would be an impossible feat to find even the same buck 1 year to the next.
And yeah, and that's the same thing that I've had to learn, right? It's like sitting down. And so, like, I should be used to that from a whitetail standpoint, right? I should be used to sitting down and really just waiting and maybe getting behind the glass and doing that. But what I've always found myself is I'd see a drainage across the valley or something. All right, get the spotter out, get the binos out. All right, give it a couple hours. Nothing happens and then go. And so it wasn't last year, but the year before, I went back to an old spot that I'd been the previous year. First day I went in and I glassed a huge, you know, I saw a ton of does. I saw a little bit, a couple spikes, and that was it. And so the next morning I went to the same spot, and then I went back across even further into the public, and I sat for that afternoon. I sat and glassed a different series of drainages and ridges. And lo and behold, I didn't see anything until one stood up, and these deer can materialize out of nothing. He was going from his, yeah, it's crazy. And so he was going from like one bed to, I think they, you know, like, I hate to use the terminology because I don't feel like I deserve to use it yet, but they call it the second bed. So when the sun shifts, the shade shifts, and then they stand out, and then they go find a new place to bed to get back in that afternoon shade before they stand up and ultimately go out to feed again. And so out of nowhere, and these deer can hide, you know, from a mule deer standpoint, they can hide in plain sight. It's like the ability that how they can do that still blows my mind. And I've been out there 4 years now chasing these animals. And so, or 3 years, four different trips. And so, I don't know, man, it was absolutely crazy watching this deer just materialize out of nothing. I'm like, is that a deer butt? And then I followed him to his second bed, and I put a stock on him. And by the time I got there, he wasn't there. And so, I don't know. It's just learning how to do all of this again is, and putting, learning how to just be patient and sit and knowing when to make the moves. And it's probably better out there. Like learning when to be aggressive and go in for a stalk, and knowing when, okay, maybe you should just give it a little bit more time. Let's see what he does. Maybe he'll be here tomorrow. Maybe he won't. You know, it's like those are the scenarios where you roll the dice, and it just, and the more you do it, the better you get at it. And I'm not to that. I don't think I'm to that point yet. Like I'm still absorbing as much information as possible.
Yeah, and I mean, there's always more to absorb. Like much as you think you can learn out there, there's another learning experience, you know, that afternoon or, right. And you have to figure it out quickly. Otherwise you're just going to be putting on lots of miles and doing lots of work. And if you don't learn from, you know, what you saw the day before, or you learn from, blowing a deer out of an area when you should have waited, like it's going to be difficult to keep at it year after year, unless you have that mindset. Now, you had mentioned your glassing both with binos and a spotting scope. Are you bringing both out when you go out there?
Oh yeah, yep. Spotters are where I hunt, and I guess how I hunt. They're a necessity, especially if you really want to pick apart a certain drainage or landscape. Like, and then another thing that the spotter does is you can see deer through your binos, and then certain counties and certain units in certain states have a, you know, like for me, is that a legal buck, or is it just a spike? Is it a legal buck, or is it a doe? So if I see a whole bunch of does, I can't shoot a doe, a mule deer doe in certain areas. So I have to say to myself, okay, well, it's not worth going into that area if there's no bucks in there. So then you back out, or you put the binos up until you can actually identify deer, get the spotter out for the details, and then say, okay, it's worth moving into that area a little bit further.
Yeah, I've got a love-hate relationship with spotting scopes. I love them because you can truly identify what you're about to go after. You can right. get a really close look. I hate them because they have ruined my credibility with my hunting buddies so many times. I'll be like, dude, I got one. And I'm looking at something and I think it's an elk. And hey, I just saw it turned its head to the left. It's facing that direction. And my eyes, I mean, you know how it is when you're glassing that long, your eyes play tricks on you. And then they're like, oh, right. let's get a better look. They pull out the spotter and I've been looking at a stump. And I've been so been embarrassed there. And then I watch these guys who have been doing it for 18 years and the same thing happens to them. So I don't feel quite as bad.
Yeah. Yep. That's a fact. And learning, I mean, learning how to identify, you look for subtleties and you look for very small little movements and things like that, that start to catch your eye. And still, you know, you watch some of these shows where guys are picking out mule deer in the shade at thousands of yards through a spotter, and they're like, oh, got one, just from a subtle head turn. And like, I'm not to that level yet. Hopefully someday I can get to that level, but that there's only one way to get there, and that's just more hunting seasons under the belt.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I experience that every time I go out there. Day one, yeah. I have a really hard time finding the animals. And then it seems like by the end of the week, you know, I'll catch just a hoof underneath a cedar tree. And I'm like, hey, there's an elk over there, or there's a deer over there.
Yeah.
And they're like, where? I don't see it. I just saw a foot. That's all I saw. But there's one in there.
Yeah.
No way. And sure enough,
or,
you wait long enough and they pop out.
Yeah, where you do it. We did one year and it was like, oh my God, we finally found a good buck to go chase. And so I'm like, do you see it? He's like, oh my God, that's a big buck. You know, it's probably I'm going to say it's 3/4 of a mile from where we were at under a little pine tree up in some real deep cut. We're like, okay, let's go make a move on him. We get there and it's just a branch, right? It's like, like we just walked, you know, we just walked a mile and a half to get here, you know, a mile there and a mile back to where we were at. And so it's just like, oh my God, you know, what a waste of time. But, it's just the part of the learning process.
Yeah. And that's part of the fun of it all. I mean, looking back at my first year, before I started hunting this unit with my buddies, there was a really bad burn. I mean, it burnt a ton of land. I don't know how many thousands of acres, but it was a lot. And I get out there and we sit down and we start glassing. And I think we were there like the 2 days before, but we got there late in the day, 2 days before season. And they're like, hey, we've got a couple hours left. Let's go see if we can locate something just for, you know, intel throughout for the next week. And we get to this burn and I'm thinking to myself, like, are you guys idiots? There's nothing, like there's no cover at all. It's just bare ground and black trees. We don't need binos. We don't need spotters. We don't need any of it. And like you said, they materialize out of nowhere. It's like all of a sudden you see one and then you realize there's 70 elk that have been in plain sight the entire time. And it had me fooled. And now I'm like, that one experience has turned me into a much more patient glasser. And I will say, glassing is one of my favorite activities now. Like the amount of things that you can see if you sit down behind a tripod with your binos or a spotter on it, it's just so cool to see deer and elk and bear when they have no idea you're anywhere around.
Right. Yep. And I don't know. And so I guess at this point, I'm just trying to figure it out. I am nowhere near any, like I'm still a Western rookie. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like there is no experience level in me. And so, and this is one of those things where like, even if I do, let's say pull something off, and, you know, yeah, I shot a whitetail there, but that wasn't my goal last year. My goal was to go shoot a mule deer. And so we ran in, we were looking for mule deer, and then we ran into this nice little area that was holding some good whitetails, and wouldn't you have it, we put a plan together, one fell in my lap. That's awesome. But that's a whitetail, right?
Yeah.
I didn't go out there specifically to hunt whitetail. You know, I could have went to Missouri or Illinois or Wisconsin or Minnesota to do that. Now, that not the same terrain, because that's unique. That's unique where I killed this whitetail at. But this year, I'm removing whitetail out of the equation by going to a place where there's no whitetails. Oh, okay. And so, or I've never seen them before. So I don't want, you know, I'm taking whitetails out of the equation so that I really focus on what I ultimately want. And that's a mule deer, a legal mule deer.
I don't know if you like playing the hypothetical game at all, but say you go into this area where you're unaware of whitetail.
Right.
At what inch bracket, if you will, would you end up shooting a whitetail if you saw it in this area when you're specifically going for muleys?
Well, I mean, out there, so I shot maybe last year a whitetail that was a whitetail buck that was 100, maybe he's 100 inches, right? He's he's an awesome character. He's got two kickers coming off of his G2s, but he's a mainframe 8. He's 100, 105 inches, something like that. And so I don't know. I mean, if there's a giant, like 145, 150 inch whitetail that gives me a shot opportunity, yeah, I would probably take it. But that's why I'm going into these locations that are off the food sources that whitetail typically hang out at. And I'm in mule deer country. So hopefully I won't turn it down, but hopefully I'm going into these areas to not have opportunities with whitetails.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I hope I answered your question.
No, you definitely did. I'm like, I do like the whole idea of going into an area that could have both. And, you know, I've got friends, they did the same thing. They were in Wyoming and they had an either whitetail or mule deer tag, and they were wanting to shoot a mule deer really bad. And these whitetails just kept giving them opportunities, and they ended up shooting one. But I'm like, man, it'd be tough if you're like a first time, if you're a rookie to the West, you know, even if it's not your first time, if you're there 4 years and you've been wanting a mule deer really bad and you're like, no whitetails for me. There's always a point at which you're like, well, okay, that game plan is out the window. Like, this is an amazing deer.
Yeah.
I'm going to take it.
Right.
Have you upgraded since, I think you said, has it been 4 seasons or did you say 3?
It's been 3 seasons, 4 trips out there. So okay. 1 year I didn't find success in October when I went. So then I went back out there in December and found even more unsuccess.
Have you in those 3 seasons and in the 4 trips, have you upgraded any of your other equipment? I know you're talking about lightening some of your sleeping equipment. What about your archery equipment or your glass or your boots? Have you had to make improvements on that?
Nope, same stuff. If anything, I feel like I've downgraded. And what I mean by that is just not packing in as much stuff with me, and like all this stuff that I thought I needed, but I didn't need. And so I guess becoming a little bit more minimalistic, like 1 year I packed in a small pillow. Well, I don't need a pillow, right? I don't bring one year I brought in a padded seat to sit on. Well, I found myself not even taking it off my pack and just sitting in the dust and in the rocks and things like that. So I didn't bring that anymore. The boots, I used those boots for 3 years. They worked great. So when it comes to my gear, I'm not like a crazy person other than this year. I wanted to reduce the amount, the size and the weight, not necessarily weight, just volume of things. And so as I reduced my sleeping bag, got a lighter one, the profile of that sleeping bag also became smaller. I'm probably going to buy a smaller tent this year, like I mentioned, that's going to be ultra lightweight. And so when I say lightweight, it means it's going to be have a smaller profile as well. And so that's just going to give me the opportunity to put more food and water in my pack. The benefit is that it's not going to weigh as much, but I'm still going to replace that. I'm not necessarily cutting weight because I'm going to replace it with food and water.
Yeah. Speaking of food, what is your food, I guess not regimen, but what are you bringing out there? Is it typically like Mountain House or some type of freeze-dried meal?
Yeah, it just depends. So when I went to Nebraska, we were able to hunt from the truck most of the day. So I slept in the bed of my truck on these hunts. And so I ended up going and getting just a cooler full of food for the most part. You know, I could make a ham sandwich, or I can eat some chips, or I can eat some fresh fruit or some bananas or apples or, you know, jerky from home and things like that. But then when I'm packing in, right, it's all freeze-dried food, right? Bars. So like Peakery Fuel is a brand that I like to use a lot. Yeah, I do use some Mountain House type meals. Like just regular granola bars, some protein bars for breakfast. Snack throughout the day, I usually bring trail mix in some individual serving sizes, along with some jerky and some. So I take a bar, like I usually have a bar for breakfast, and then I have a sack full of food for the day, which typically includes the trail mix that I make, the jerky, and then, you know, maybe some stuff if I want something a little bit more flavorful to add to my water, I'll do that. And then when I get back is when I usually consume most of my calories, and that's with like a Peak Refuel or a Mountain House meal.
Nice. I've gone out with such little food before, and I realized that having good food to eat when I'm out there can make all the difference in my mindset. I did that mountain goat hunt, and the guy came with, and he brought honey sticks, and he brought those. I don't even know. They're like a honey wafer, like a real thin cookie.
Oh yeah. Bee stinger.
Yes. Oh my like stingers. Gosh, man. Yeah. He brought those, and I'm like, how have I gone this long without knowing about this stuff? But then, right. I've got some friends that are really into rock climbing, and they make these bars. They're called 1,000 calorie bars, and it is just loaded with like walnuts and almonds and pecans, honey, oats, peanut butter, you name it, it's probably in it.
Yeah.
And so I got the recipe from them, and now my wife makes like 2 giant cookie trays full of them, and we bring those out. But at the end of the day, no matter how good the stuff is that you can just pull out of your pack, like once you can actually warm up a meal, there's nothing like hot food after a hard day of hiking or glassing or hunting.
Yeah, that's a fact. And at the same time, I'm kind of a dog when I'm out in the backcountry. I will eat the same, I'll eat the same thing every day. Yeah. But when I'm in my truck, then I have the ability to have more variety. And then, if you're from your truck, man, I'm going to run into town and grab a burger at the bar or go to a quick restaurant and get something, like a warm cooked homemade meal, and you're not having to eat another freeze dried meal. Some of those freeze dried meals, don't get me wrong, they're great, but a big fat burger when you're exhausted is so good.
Oh yeah. We found ourselves doing that. So we set up a huge base camp. I mean, people have their side-by-sides and their toy haulers, their campers. One group of guys, they brought basically a converted semi-trailer all the way back, and they eat like kings there. But we'll go out and we'll do spike camp for a couple days, And what's really funny is watching the other groups of guys that go out and spike camp somewhere for 3 or 4 days, they come back and before like a Philly cheesesteak on the Flatiron, the first thing they always go for is a cold beer. As soon as they get to camp, it's like, where's the cooler? And we have a great time there, but there's nothing like getting one cleaned up. We do.
Oh yeah.
Typically, I feel like every other night, somebody or other goes into town and they'll just go pay for a shower at the truck stop. And when you can go and get cleaned up midweek, it like refuels you, gets you ready to go again. But then you're always wondering like, did I miss out on something this evening?
right. Yeah. I always get a hotel. Especially if we're sleeping in the truck and I know it's going to be a rain delayed day, we'll throw a, or we're close, right? We'll get a hotel for a night, freshen up, and then, or on like the second trip that I made to Nebraska this year, we stayed in hotels every night because they were close. It was just a drive into town. So, but the first trip I made out to Nebraska was a little, like we had a couple days where it was like a really long drive. We spent the night, and then a rain delay day, we spent the night. But then other than that, the guy I was with, he pitched a tent and I slept in the back of the truck and that's pretty comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, I feel like everything for Western hunting, whether it be food prep, lessening your gear, or building, a back of your truck bed living quarters, like there's people who get in really deep to every single aspect of it.
Right. And there's some of that stuff where I probably need to, but I got a piece of foam for my bed and I got a decent sleeping bag and by the end of the day, man, I could sleep on pavement or on a gravel rock. I'm so tired. So I fall asleep anywhere.
Yeah. Have you gotten into going back to any of those places shed hunting?
Nope. Haven't done that. And it really all comes back to time. I really do want to come and go do that stuff, but it's like I'm weighing my options. I can go take a trip to scout, but then I'm usually going to have to give up some other type of trip throughout the year at some point. And so, it's just, they're all hunting trips. And so I really haven't focused on any scouting trips or shed hunting trips or things like that. I should maybe go do a turkey hunt in some of those spots. And that instead of, while I'm there in the afternoons, go do some scouting. But really it's just the trip is just to hunt.
Yeah. No, I understand that. I have yet to do an actual shed trip. And this time of year, it kills me because I am one, the world's worst shed hunter when it comes to whitetail sheds. I can't seem to find whitetail sheds. I found my first one actually this year while actually looking. I've stumbled across a couple other ones like totally out of the blue, but I went out specifically for sheds, ended up finding one. I was really pumped. It was this tiny, tiny little 4-point side, but it didn't matter to me at all. But out west, man, there are so many antlers on the ground and I end up finding them when I'm hunting and I'm like, dude, I could come back here like in the spring and find them while they're brown. It would be amazing. I've always wanted to have that whole backpack full of mule deer and elk sheds hiking out of the mountains.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. That would definitely be fun.
Yeah. Hopefully one day.
One day.
But man, I appreciate you hopping on, sharing all your experiences and gear and strategies. I'm going to be right behind you. I mean, I'm 3 years back now, but archery is the next step in my evolution when it comes to Western hunting.
Yeah.
That is,
yeah.
Everybody I talk to, they're like, dude, once you get into archery, be careful because, you might not need a rifle for hunting out west anymore.
Right. And I'd much rather hunt in some temperate type climate weather than I would, hiking up a mountain in snow. So that's why That's why I hunt archery.
Yeah, it makes sense. I don't like the heat, though. That's the one thing. I know some of those places can get pretty hot. And I should say they've gotten warm even late rifle seasons for me. But I'm a much bigger fan of the cold than the heat. But I'd love it, you know, if it was 40 to 60 degrees all the time. We all know that's not possible.
Yeah. I'm the opposite. I guess I'd rather sit and sweat than I would sit and freeze.
Oh, man. I don't understand people like you, Dan. I know we share the same name, but we are cut from a different cloth.
There you go.
I can't do that. But, man, thanks. I hope you all the best this fall when you're out hunting. And, dude, good luck, man. I hope you get tested out there. I hope that 145-inch whitetail comes out, and then you really have to make the choice.
Gosh dang it. Why can't you just say, hey, I hope a 145-inch mule deer comes by? Because that'd shoot that too.
Isn't that what I said? Oh, I said whitetail.
No, you said whitetail. So, hey, man, I really appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. And that is going to wrap it up for today's show. I hope you guys enjoyed that. I mean, it is always awesome being able to talk to somebody in the outdoor world that you really look up to. And to hear about Dan and his passion for going after mule deer out west and the change that he had to adapt to from hunting whitetail in Iowa to actually going and pursuing with your bow on foot in their bedroom, big mule deer, elk, antelope, like going and experiencing things like that would just be so sweet with a bow. It's a lot of fun already with a rifle, but I can't imagine like the intimacy that you would experience spotting one from 1,000 yards away. I mean, he said like 3/4 of a mile on some of these, and then hoping that it's still in its bed by the time you get over there, having to sneak in undetected in an area where there are a ton of predators and a ton of dangers. And so their alerts are already high, but oh man, I'm getting pumped already. I'm hoping to go do some archery hunting out west this year and in a lot of future years. So we'll see how that all plays out. But I will say, I want you guys to be taking a lot away from these. I know that we get into a lot of stories and it kind of is a BS session, but as far as strategy and tips and gear and all of that stuff, I hope that you guys are kind of gleaning some information from us as we're talking about the gear that we use or how much it weighs or the food that we eat. Hopefully you guys can take that, put it into practice on your own Western hunts. And I already know for myself, like walking away from this conversation, I need to lighten my load. I've got so much stuff. I've got bulky stuff that's heavy, and I think that just comes from like getting into it as cheap as possible, and there's nothing wrong with that. I could go out and do the same hunts that I always do with the same gear that I always do, but in hearing him talk about like lightening his gear sometimes by a pound and a half in one item, that's a lot when it comes down to thinking about how many items I have. Like I used to do the same thing, bring a pillow. Well, guess what? I've got down jackets and pants and outerwear, and I can turn that into a pillow super easy. But I think I'm gonna hop on Amazon, because who doesn't love going on Amazon, finding new deals, looking at ratings and reviews? Maybe that's what I'll do today. Maybe I could look at like sleeping bags and pads, a new tent. Oh man, I could have a lot of money spent right now before I even finish recording this. But I'm gonna let you guys off. I hope you guys enjoyed it, and as always, get out there and chase a new adventure.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.